Jerusalem. How I long for you to gaze at your walls.
And now we come to that Torah portion. Yeah, it's the Torah portion of the 12 spies, the 10 bad spies, the 2 good spies. And I got to tell you, it's a fairly easy Torah portion. I think pretty much anybody could stand up and make some kind of sense out of this Torah portion. But I just don't like it. It's not my favorite Torah portion out of all the 54 of them. And the reason being is because it's about failure. Okay, it really comes down to this: that from the beginning to the end, it's about the failure of the Hebrews, the failure of the tribes. And I remember, you know, in my early days in Assembly of God in various places, that any time that you wanted to come up with a sermon of, you know, how terrible the Hebrews were, those Jews, and that's kind of where it tends to go. You know, when you start talking about the Hebrews, it's really kind of a springboard of how the Jews are still doing the same thing. I'll just kind of leave that alone. But it was this Torah portion, though they wouldn't know to even have called it a Torah portion, but it was kind of used to beat up on them and to show how terrible they were. And maybe in showing how terrible they were, we could consider that wow, you know, I mean, we're doing much better than they are. Really? Is that true? Maybe so, maybe not, okay? So as we look through the Torah portion, if you get this attitude of, wow, you know, they were really terrible, ask yourself a question. Would you have been the 10 or the 2? Which side? I ask myself the question. I mean, I want to, beyond a shadow of a doubt, you know, no thought in my mind, I want to say, yeah, I would have been there with Joshua and Caleb. Really? Would I? I don't know. I guess that maybe that test is ahead of us. And so The wording here, Adonai Yudhevave said to Moshe, send men on your behalf to reconquer the land of Canaan. We'll see this further clarified over, of course, in the book of Devarim, Deuteronomy, when it says that it wasn't really Moshe's idea. It wasn't the Almighty's idea. It appears that this was a weakness in the leadership of Moshe. I'm being a little, using a little bit of judgment there maybe. But I can understand where Moshe's at here. I really can. He's been in leadership with these people for a number of years now. And anyone that's ever been in leadership, and by the way, if you've been a parent, if you're a grandparent, you know, that's called leadership. And leadership can be lonely. Leadership can be something that wears you down. Leadership can make you very weary. You can just become tired. And there comes a time, consider that, you know, raising your children, did anybody ever make any mistakes in that parenting? Because the children came and it's like, oh, I've said no 100 times. Go ahead, whatever, okay? And you end up making the wrong decision because the children kind of wore you down some. And it happens. It happens to everybody. Did it happen to Moshe? Was this just a moment in time in which, you know, he woke up one morning and he was tired, he was weary, and he sided with the people? I wonder if this was really the beginning of what would happen later on with the striking of the rock the second time, and this would eventually keep him out of the land. Okay, these are all things of speculation, but I think it's questions that we should ask, and here's a question that each of us should be asking ourselves when it comes to the leaders that are in our own lives. And we should all have people that we're looking to leadership. Do we have a tendency to kind of wear them down? I have people not at Life Assembly. Okay, nobody there. All right, those of you that are listening, not talking to you. But I get emails, messages, texts, carrier pigeons, and sometimes I'll look at the on the phone. You get that notification, and you see the name come up, and it's like, what now? What in the world do they want now? Because you know it's always something that's just going to suck the energy out of you. And it's normally something that's totally irrelevant. But because of the position that you've been called to, you feel like you need to kind of walk it out. So my advice, my counsel to you is this. Be kind to your leaders. Be kind to those. Don't be the drain on your leaders. Be the one who is energizing the people, not just the leaders, but the people around you. Ask a question. This is a very crucial question. Are we today, in the places we are in, the people we're around, are you a drain or are you energizing? One of the two, okay? So that's just a nice little piece of advice there. It says, send the men on your behalf. Now, the word send is, and I'm very grateful to a man, Brad Scott, of blessed memory. If there's one thing that Brad taught me that I remember, Brad taught me many things. Probably most of them I don't remember, but one of them I do. And that is that... If you want to understand a word in Hebrew, go back to the first place that it was used, and that will bring forth a meaning. And so the first place, this word send, is found over in Genesis chapter 3, and it's right after the fall, and it says in the last part of verse 22 of chapter 3, now to prevent his putting out his hand and taking from the tree of life, eating and living forever, goes on from there. The putting forth of his hand, and this word, you can trace it down through Genesis, very, very interesting word of reaching out. Okay, he was saying that Adam was so that he would not reach out to the tree of life and therefore be stuck in the state that he was in sin, okay? That was actually a gift from the Almighty. Death is a gift. It is part of the curse, but it's very much a gift in the end. We'll go into the fullness of meaning there. But it's the word send out men. So put them forth. Stretch out their hand into the land. It's, to me, it comes down to a very simple lesson of life. Watch out what you're stretching your hand forth to. Watch out. Be careful. Be discerning of what we're reaching out to. There's things that today we should be reaching out to, we should be grasping, and there are things that we should be leaving at arm's distance. It's like, no, I don't need to be holding that in my hand today. Many things that are in the world today that we don't need to be hanging on to. And then it says, on behalf to recounter the land. Now, probably everybody knows this. This is the word in Hebrew of tour. It's T-O-O-R. Of course, very similar in English. It's not where the word tour came from from Hebrew, but it's an interesting correlation here. The word tour, so they were sending, what is he sending them out? As tourists. He was sending out to spy out the land. They were to go and they were to look in the land, but here's the problem. Why did they need to do this? Why? What was the purpose? What was the purpose in going and touring the land? It wasn't, well, they brought back some souvenirs, yes. But, we go today on our Connect to Israel tour and we go to, as it says, connect with the land, with the people, the Elohim of the land. We're going because we can't go there yet. We're still in exile. We're still in the diaspora. but it's about visiting. But even today, you know, people go to Israel with different expectations. I'm quick to counsel people that I'm taking on tours to Israel of make sure that your expectations are his expectations. In fact, get yours out of the way so that yours don't get in the way of his expectations. But you're not to go, if you take a tour of the land, you're not going there to judge the land. You're going there to perceive what the land is going to be. That's actually the word that's over in chapter 18, or excuse me, chapter 13, verse 18, and see what the land is like. It's that word ray, talked about that many times, and it is, they were to go over and see it through the eyes of Yah. But that's not their purpose. That's not why they were going, the 10 at least. That's not why they were going. They wanted to see through their eyes so that they can make sure that the Almighty was actually not telling them a little bit of a fib. It wasn't a, you know, well, I know what he said, but, and this brings out something for our day, you know, it's questioning. How long does a person have to live? How long does a person have to follow the Almighty before you quit listening to that voice? You don't know what the voice I'm talking about? Yeah, you do. Come on. That voice that says, well, you know, I know that he's taken care of me for, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. I know he's taken care of me all my life. I mean, I can even see how he took care of me before I was even following him. I have my cousin, Melanie, loves to say, and sometimes I've heard her in prayer say, thank you for loving me before I knew to love you. Even before we knew to follow and serve and love him, he was there loving us. But it's like, I know that he's done that all these years, but you know, but what about tomorrow? Is he going to be like decide to take a vacation from taking care of me? I don't believe that there's a place in our lives that we ever come to that spot of saying, of not hearing that voice. You know, it's like on your computer or whatever you're using, your phone, there's those buttons of volume up, volume down, and then there's the mute button. I love mute buttons. Those are wonderful. I'll leave that alone. But there's that mute button. And that voice that's in there that keeps questioning his word, it's like, I wish I could find the mute button for that. And then like, you know, hit that mute button and then destroy every button around it so that that it can't be taken off. But the truth is, it doesn't happen that way. But what can happen is that we take control of that voice. See, the greater thing would not be to mute the voice, but to control the voice so that we have the ability in our life to make that voice louder or make that voice softer. And the victory of life is this, that voice becomes so soft that we really don't pay any more attention to it because we're paying attention to his voice, which we've turned the volume up on over and over again. So this whole thing of going into the land, recontouring the land, it's all about questioning his word, which is something that mankind has really down to a T. Now, they send out these men into the land. And if you ever go back to the genealogy of Noach, okay? Very, very commonly known now that the genealogy has, each name has meaning. And you can form a sentence from there. It's a very beautiful, meaningful sentence. I won't go there. But you can go to the 12 tribes. You can go to various places in Scripture. Every name has meaning. So I just decided this morning that I'd look at it and I'd see, is it possible that these names have some kind of meaning to them as the Hebrews are watching these men go out, you know, riding out toward the sunset, that they're actually seeing a message? So I started this. I was going to take a few minutes, and it turned into about 30 minutes, partially because I had to keep all the names right, and I'd have to go back, you know, with the back button. I get confused and have tried again because a couple places, the same, there's a different name that has the same meaning, and so really confused me. But here's what we come up with in the end. All right, ready for this? These names of the men who were sent out, starting with Shammua, his name means renowned. All right, so I'll just read you the sentence that this comes out with. Renowned one who has judged, he is loyal as a dog, bringing forth redemption, salvation, deliverance, and fortune in the heavenly realm and the earthly realm. He is my kinsman, who is doubly hidden in the majesty of Yah. Okay, you want to rewind it? You want me to just do it again? All right. So I'll give you a hint that some of these names, as I said, have the same meaning, but a slightly different meaning when you start looking toward the root of them. And so it says, renowned one who has judged, he is as loyal as a dog, bringing redemption and salvation, deliverance, and fortune in the heavenly and earthly realm. He is my kinsman who is doubly hidden in the majesty of Yah. Now, first of all, is that fortune. One of them is, one of the words has an L after it, which is where I kind of translated that into the heavenly realm. The other one does not, which I translate into the earthly realm. And then there's this hidden. This, he is my kinsman who is doubly hidden in the majesty of Yah. Why is it that he hides things? Well, we could go to verses in Devarim, in Proverbs, loosely quoting that it is his pleasure to hide things, to watch us seek them out. In fact, Yeshua would say it like this. He would say, blessed are those who seek first the kingdom of Elohim. He says to knock and keep on knocking, to seek and keep on seeking, to search and keep on searching. And so here's a kind of a thought for you, that it says he's hidden. He's doubly hidden. So the kinsman redeemer is doubly hidden in the majesty of Yah. There's a hiding something, and then there's a really hiding it. Okay, you have something that you want to hide from whoever, so you put it like in a drawer, but then you want to really hide it, so you put it, you know, kind of like under the drawer or something like that, okay? And the typical person comes along, they might open a drawer, find something, but they're not going to really search for something. So there are different levels of the hiding of the truth of the Almighty and of the Messiah. If we go again to Proverbs or to Psalm 40, which says that, behold, I'm coming in the scroll, the book is written of me. And I've talked to Jewish friends. When I say that, I've got a lot of Jewish friends, so don't try to put names on. I've talked to Christian friends, and I've talked to them about, you know, Messiah is hidden in the Torah. And they're like, huh? You've talked to your family. Well, you know, why are you studying those first five books? Why do you call them again? And you say, because I'm finding the Messiah is hidden within. And they're like, you're crazy. We don't need those books to find the Messiah. We got it all over there in Matthew, you know. Why did I use a southern accent? I don't know. It just sounded better. But you've had the same experience, right? I have. But then there's a level of the surface level of Messiah that's within the pages of Scripture. And this is, then there's a deeper level. Here's a statement for you. The level of revelation that you are walking in today is the level of revelation that you desire. Now, the tragedy is that there is a level of revelation that people become satisfied with. My question, are you satisfied with the level of revelation that you're walking in or not? There is no end. There is no end to the revelation. We were discussing this last week at Life Assembly, bringing forth I was talking about the menorah and how we can spend a collective lifetime studying the menorah and never come to the end of the revelation. And in fact, as I was teaching on it last Shabbat, I saw something I'd never seen before. And I've taught on the menorah for how many years now? I've listened to how many people teach on the menorah? But yet, there's revelation that keeps coming and keeps coming and keeps coming unless you become satisfied with your revelation. If you get up in the morning and you know, let me ask you a question. What is, when you wake up and you get up and you get, you know, kind of awake there in the, however long that takes some people, some it's less time than others, I know that. But what's kind of your thought process in the morning? What's the first thing on your mind in the morning? I'm not going to go into things because then I'm going to pick on that person and not on that person. But is there a desire in the morning to spend at least a few moments with him? Spend a few moments in his word? Is there something in his word that moment, that morning he has that he'd like to reveal to you that will be enriching for the day that you have ahead of you? Or, you know, it's the first thing, I wonder what Facebook says. You know, it's got it, okay? So just something to think about. Doubly hidden in the majesty of Yah. They were told to enter the land and perceive the land, not judge the land. They were to perceive it as from the spiritual, from the word that the Father had already spoken in their lives, not what they were seeing, which is what we have to do today in the world in general, not just the land of Israel. And it goes on, it says, and see whether the land is fertile or unproductive and whether there is wood in it or not. Okay, why? Why do they have to go and look in the land to see? The Almighty, here's my point. The Almighty has already said that is a land flowing with milk and honey. Which means he's already stated that it is fertile. It is productive. Everything that is needed is there for you. But they're not taking his word. They need to look at it with their own eyes. And here's the sin of the 10 spies. They questioned the word of the Almighty. Now, the judgment here for their decision, moving a little bit ahead of myself, the judgment for their decision is this, that they will not enter into the land.
Jerusalem, how I long for you to gaze at your walls.
This is known as the time that it's actually said that this is the ninth of Av, and this is that time which is mourned in Judaism, the ninth of Av. It's so many things happened, and it is said that this is what brought, and I don't know this specifically, but it said this is what brought this into play, that they would be plagued in generation after generation because of this decision. But yet you go back to the golden calf, which in maybe in our minds was a greater sin. But the golden calf was an attack on his image. The 10 spies was an attack on his character. And this is what I consider. He is much more concerned about his character than his image. You can mess with his image some. I don't know what limit there is on that, but you can mess with his image a little bit and come up with some golden calves, but don't mess with his word. And I guess I can relate to that. If there's one thing that in life that probably bothers me or actually brings forth some anger when you question my word. That's something you just don't do. You know, don't look at me and say, well, you know, you lied to me. You don't want to go there, okay? Because if you think I lied to you, it was something that was misinterpreted. Guaranteed, it was misinterpreted of something between us, okay? Because I want my word to be my word, period. And so don't question my word. You can mess with my image a little bit. That's, you know, make fun of something, whatever, okay? But it's my word. And so this is something that the Father has here, is they questioned his character in not going into the land. And they did so by saying, we can't attack those people because they are stronger than we are. This is David Stern translation. They are stronger than we are, but would probably better be translated, they are stronger than he is. Is it they are stronger than us, or are they stronger than him? Or is it both? See, if they question that they're stronger than us, that's truth. Okay, they were speaking truth. That which was in the land was stronger than them. That's truth. But they were questioning not just if they are stronger than us, but are they stronger than him. Which is, again, questioning his character and the word that said, I will bring you into the land. Now, go back just a little bit. The fertile or unproductive, and whether there is a tree, is wood in it or not. The word is etz. It's not wood. It's wood, but it's better translated tree. And we could go a lot of different places with this one. The word tree there, etz. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers. The word tree, etz, is normally speaking of righteous. So men are referred to as trees of righteousness. So he was saying, see if there's any righteousness in the land. Again, why is it that this needs to be discussed? Does it matter? Does it matter that there's righteousness in the land? No. It doesn't, because they are called to be the righteousness that is entering the land. So it doesn't matter if there is righteousness in the land or not. They're not adding to the righteousness. They are the righteousness. It's like you and I walking into a room. We should be able to walk into a room in which there is no righteousness at all, no light at all. We should be able to walk into the darkest room, and we enter in, there's light. We bring the righteousness in the room. This is where a lot of people fail, because people don't see themselves for who they really are. Verse I've been using for Life Assembly and for other places is this: if the same Spirit that raised Messiah from the dead dwells in you, he shall quicken your mortal body. Book of Romans. If the same Spirit that raised Messiah from the dead dwells in you. I mean, when Messiah walked into a room, the room changed, did it not? So if the same Spirit that raised Messiah from the dead dwells in us, then when we enter into a room, the room should change. Question is this: when you enter a room, do you change the room, or does the room change you? Now, I wish I could say that I was really always good at this, but I'm not. Okay, it's something I work on. I desire for a room to change when I enter the room. That means that if there's coarse language in the room, if there's coarse joking in the room, if there's, whatever is in the room, you and I have the ability, we have the choice to allow ourselves. And let me just take it to another place. It's easy to find a room of complaining these days, is it not? I mean, any room, pretty much any room you walk into, in the United States at least, I can't speak for other countries, I think it's probably the same, but most every room you walk into is going to be a room of complaining. So what are you doing? Are you entering in and allowing the room to change you? What are you bringing in the room? Now, if you're bringing righteousness in the room, don't expect that everybody in the room is going to be happy about that. Because darkness loves darkness. Darkness doesn't like light. Go back to John chapter 1 and read that chapter, and it tells us about this thing between light and darkness. But that doesn't matter. Okay? It doesn't matter if the room doesn't like you. You're still called to change the room. Well, maybe to clear the room. Okay? Does your presence change the room? If it does, sometimes it'll clear the room. And maybe that's a good thing. All right, so let's move on. Briefly, this word of, just something to think about. See if there is a tree of righteousness in it. Is this why it says specifically they went up into the Negev and arrived at Hebron? I've been to Hebron. I've been to the place that they've excavated and believe that is the actual wall of the city that Joshua, Caleb, the other 10 saw. It's an amazing place to be. Is it possible that they were thinking about the garden, about the tree of life? And because the tradition is that Adam and Eve are buried there at the cave of Machpelah. We know that Abraham, Isaac, Jacob are buried at the cave of Machpelah. So were they looking for the righteousness? Were they looking for the remnant of righteousness? Were they looking for evidence of the garden? Were they expecting it to be a garden instead of expecting it to be something they had to fight for? And therein lies, and I talked to Barry Phillips on this this past week on Foundations for Life. That was released on Wednesday. Tomorrow as I'm recording, yesterday as I'm releasing this video. So you can go to Foundations for Life. Do our expectations get in the way sometimes? Were they expecting a garden, but yet confronted with a battle? Is that kind of like looking toward the kingdom? Are we expecting a garden, but yet we'll be confronted by a battle? I'm just kind of throwing it out there, okay? So in we go all the way down. Let's see where I want to go. Okay, so they spread a negative report about the land they had reconquered for the people of Israel, and then it says in verse 33, we saw the Nephilim, the descendants of Anak, who was from the Nephilim to ourselves. Okay, there's this, and we were like grasshoppers by comparison. We looked that way to them too. Okay, there's so much to go into, and I'm probably not going to go into a lot of it here because it, to me, it becomes a bit irrelevant. There are many people today that are focusing on the Nephilim, the giants in the land. Okay, there's a lot of opinions out there. I do not believe that this was physical relations between demonic forces and flesh, humans. That's just my belief. I do not believe it was physical relations, but it was a DNA genetic modification. These were not just, you know, cavemen just coming out and learning how to walk, but there had been and still continue to be this DNA thing. And so this was possible DNA genetic modification. Who knows what we were doing, what was going on back then. Maybe the same thing that's going on right now. Different subject, but the same one. Here's the point I want to make, folks. The people that focused on the giants became bird food. Okay? You got that? The people that focused on the giants became bird food. I'm talking about the birds of the air in the wilderness. Remember? 605,000. How many? Of military age died in the wilderness, which means that over 605,000 people became bird food. Why? Because they focused on giants. Very simple. Don't focus on giants or you'll be bird food. Focus on the Almighty, and you'll enter in the land. Can't say it any plainer than that, I don't think. Okay, I guess I could, but I don't think I can. Chapter 14 begins by saying, you know, why is Adonai bringing us out here? We wish we had died in Egypt or had died here in the desert. They got their wish, okay? They're like, well, we wish we'd have just died back there in Egypt, or we wish we'd have died here in the wilderness. Okay, that's what you're wishing for. That's what you're wishing for. That's what you got. That's what you're going to get. They didn't get Egypt. They got the wilderness, okay? So once again, be careful of what you're wishing for. When we start questioning his word to bring us forth and to deliver us, don't be surprised when he doesn't deliver you. You know, the words of Job, that which I feared has come upon me. It's, if you expect the worst, don't be surprised when you get it. It wasn't the will of the Almighty, was it? It wasn't his will. His will was to be as loyal to them as a dog, bringing redemption, salvation, deliverance, and heavenly and earthly wealth, fortune unto them. That was his will. But instead, they focused on the giants. They focused on what they saw, and look what happened. Let's don't make the same mistakes again. In verse 4 of this same chapter, chapter 14, It says, if I can find verse 4, it's not on that page. I got to go back. And they said to each other, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. We don't like Moshe anymore. We don't like the place we're going. And this is a theme that we're going to see from this point on in the book of Bamidbar, of returning. And it's not the word aliyah. Okay, it's a word, I find it interesting, it doesn't really have these meanings, but it's the word sub. In Hebrew, it is spelled S-U-B, basically, is how we would translate it over into English. So it's not about going up. See, in return, we have a choice of how to return. We can make aliyah and return unto him, or we can be a submarine. We can go to the subsurface. Either one. It's a constant choice, folks. It's a constant choice. Continuing up the mountain or going back to the valley. One of the two. It's just the way that life is. Now, Moshe does something that, yes, I see that, I personally believe that Moshe had become weary. He was tired. He was tired of the battles that he'd gone through. That's not judgment against the guy. I can see this. I can understand this at a level. But this point with the 10 spies and the judgment that came upon the people because of it, it energized him. Okay, there was a renewal of energy here because he could have just said, you know, I'm out of here. I'm done. But instead we see him standing and pleading, interceding for the people on their behalf. And we get this wonderful revelation in chapter 14, verse 18. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is slow of anger, rich in grace, forgiving offenses and crimes, yet not exonerating the guilty, but causing the negative effects of the parents' offenses to be experienced by the children, the visitation to the children so they can be overcome, and even by to the third and fourth generation. Please forgive the offense of this people according to the greatness of your grace, just as you have borne with this people from Egypt until now. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh answered, I have forgiven as you have asked, but this was the classic of sowing your wild oats and expecting a crop failure. Yes, the Father does forgive. Thankfully, if there's one thing above all that we could probably everyone be thankful for, is that he forgives. But there's still consequences. There's consequences to what we do. There's consequences to our actions. There's consequences to our words. And so teaching our children that, you know, there's no matter what you do in life, there's going to be consequences for it, is a very good lesson to pass on from generation to generation. In fact, even to the point of when they're going through struggles in their life, I find it a good thing at times when you have an opportunity to use it from your own standpoint. Your children, your grandchildren are going through something. You know, don't act like you're, you know, so righteous that nothing has ever happened to you in your life. But take them to this verse. Take them to this verse and explain this verse to them. And maybe not go into detail that they don't need to know about, but maybe go and say, you know, as a parent, as a grandparent, I want to tell you a little bit about my life and some things that happened to me, some things that maybe happened to your parents, your grandparents that you know about. And you can tell them, you can take them to this in, as a place of saying, this that you're going through, the Father is visiting you as he visited me. I failed. I failed it. You know, when the knock came at the door, I opened the door. But you're hearing a knock of something that has been in our family for generations. You have the ability now to not answer the door and to cause that which is knocking to go away. Sometimes we need to be transparent with our children, with our grandchildren, regarding our own lives to a certain point. Be wise about that. Okay, lastly, I need to get into this. A man who was gathering wood on Shabbat. Again, this Torah portion is not one of my favorites because it's about failure. The wording, I'm told, I don't know how this comes about because I'm not that good with Hebrew, but the wording here seems to be that this was not the first time he had been caught in this action, but it's someone that had done something over and over and over again, and finally it caused him to be taken from the camp. I don't feel like we are to just destroy somebody immediately, okay? People make mistakes. Don't gloss over the mistake. But at the same time, have some grace. But if a person comes to a place that they are just, and I could go back and give an example of this, I'm not going to, but that people are brought to the place over and over and over again, and they fail to make the right decision, there comes a time of reality. The reality sets in. Yes, the Father is gracious and he is merciful, but there is a limit. And we should be, the people, it appears, had gone to him and said, you know, this is not what you're to be doing. This is Shabbat, over and over again. I'm kind of throwing a little bit of speculation into this. And he refused. It became an in-your-face kind of thing. And we see that he was taken out of the camp and he was stoned to death. Out of this, we get this wonderful verse of the tzitzit, of the placing of the blue threads on the corners of our garment. I've got a whole video, or not video, I've got a whole teaching online. You can go to joindoshem.org. You can go to, I can't remember the name of the audio. Click on audio and kind of look through there. You'll find it somewhere along the way. But you were to put a blue threads on the corners of your garment. I've gone into this extensively through the years. It's not just blue thread. There's a meaning that is there. But the word here is so that you, and obey them so that you won't go around wherever your own heart and eyes lead you to prostitute yourself. The word here of lead you is the same word that we began the Torah portion with, is tor. You are to place things around you, the blue thread specifically here, but other aspects of life, boundaries around your life, so that you won't reach out your hand in order to grasp something that is not of the Almighty. Again, it began with this, it ends with this. Let's make sure that what we're reaching out to is what we should be reaching out to. And when he tells us not to touch the hot stove, take his word for it. It's for your own good. Shabbat shalom. Shavuot tov. Have a blessed, prosperous week. Be'ezrat Hashem. God willing, see you again next week. And until then, well, I guess known for something. Be strong.